Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. Today, you'll hear one of the great untold stories of the First World War. In 1917, a whole bunch of ships mysteriously disappeared off the coasts of Australia and New Zealand. The Australian government put it down to domestic subversion. But in fact, the story was much more interesting. It was all the work of a ship called the Wolf. The Wolf was a German raider. It looked like a commercial freighter, but it was bristling with hidden guns, mines, and torpedoes. It was sent on a suicide mission from Germany to the far side of the world to disrupt Allied food supplies. Its trick was it would capture a ship, raid its supplies of coal and food, and then take the crew prisoner on board. One of the prisoners was even a little girl who became the mascot of the German sailors. My guests today to tell you this story are a lawyer and a journalist who have uncovered the story of the Wolf. Richard Gilliatt, a Walkley Award-winning journalist, and Peter Honan, whose great-uncle was one of the prisoners on the Wolf. They've written a book together that's simply called The Wolf, How One German Raider Terrorised Australia and the Southern Oceans in the First World War. Peter Honan, Richard Gilliatt, welcome to you both. Good morning.
Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
What a great yarn this is. I can't believe I haven't heard of this story before, Richard. This is just one of the great untold stories, as I've said.
Yes, well, I had the same reaction. Peter originally came to me with a lot of the research that he'd done on this story, and I hadn't heard a lot about the Wolf myself, and a lot of people had written about it in the years immediately after the war, but that was a history that was largely forgotten. And as we went deeper into the story, we discovered there were many aspects of the story that had never been uncovered.
And there was a whole lot of deception from the Australian government, and we'll come to that later. That's just perhaps one of the reasons why we don't know so much about it. If I can just ask you, Richard, just to... The ship, the Wolf, was like the original Transformer, wasn't it, really? It was a ship that could transform itself into another ship. Tell me about the ship itself.
Germany had a program of what were called commerce raiders in the First War, and they were clandestine warships. They were effectively a little bit like pirate ships. They were freighters that were rigged out with a whole lot of hidden weapons, and they were sent out into the oceans to destroy as much British and Allied trade as possible. And to do that, they fitted them out so that they just looked like ordinary freighters, so they would approach ships looking nondescript.
Harmless.
Yes.
And then suddenly these weapons would appear, the bulwarks would drop open, guns would swing out, torpedo tubes would appear, and the freighters, which were generally unarmed or had only one small gun, would pretty much be forced to surrender almost immediately.
Yeah, Peter, tell me about some of these technical modifications, these fiendishly clever modifications to the ship.
Well, Wolf was the most successful, I think. Nurger, the key to this is Nurger himself. He was...
The captain.
Yes, Captain Carl August Nurger, born in Rostock, the Baltic town. He'd wanted to be an architect when he was at school. His father was a headmaster. He'd brought up in a very strict Prussian tradition of chivalry and service and so on. And I think he had that sort of planning mind. And in one of the books written by his artillery officer, a fellow called Fritz Wojciechowski, he talks about the work that went into choosing a suitable freighter and then being given carte blanche by the German Navy to convert it,
So it did begin as a freighter then. It was a real, genuine freighter.
It was Wachenfels, part of a shipping line, the name which escapes me for the moment. And it had been working as a freighter. And he wanted one with a big coal capacity because he knew he could only go so far with his coal burning. They were, you know, that's the power source of the day. And he wanted big bunkers. Destroyers couldn't carry that sort of thing. So he had to live off the sea and then capture his victims and take their coal. So he had that in mind, and he had to had a gunnery officer with him. The two of them went over this ship and said, we want this, that, and the other, and he designed it, and the aeroplane was a source of genius. The little
They had a seaplane on board.
Little
as well.
Seaplane, yeah. First time ever that a ship like this had carried a seaplane, which could be dismantled, stowed beneath. They had fantastic workshops. They could refit the ship, rebuild anything. An advanced hospital with two medicos.
So they built brilliant. These. They built, as Richard was saying, these flaps in the side of the.
That's right.
The hull. What were they, hinged or something?
They were hinged. I've got good, great movie shots of this taken at the time. They pressed a handle and the sides fell down and the guns were on an arc. 6 inches, 5.9 centimetres, 15 centimetres, sorry, near enough to 6 inches. And they swung out on an arc on the deck. And we've got good shots of that, the sailors swinging them out. So they had the firepower of a light cruiser in the Royal Navy,
Navy. It had a modified castle on its deck, didn't it, Richard, as well? Some telescopic castle.
Yeah, there were all these very clever disguising techniques that they used. One of them was to have a fake funnel, for instance, which could be expanded and raised, and the masts were telescopes, so they could go up and down as well. The reason for that was in the First War, identifying a ship was really just a matter of looking through binoculars at the horizon. There was no radar. So you're looking at a silhouette in the distance, and if you could change the silhouette of your ship, you basically looked like a different ship.
So then what would happen is one of these Allied freighters would see this outline on the horizon. It looked like a classic freighter ship. They thought, oh, well, that's quite harmless, until it would, pull up alongside?
Yes.
And then the flaps would drop, the guns would come out. And you're in deep trouble.
A signal would be sent saying, that you're under attack, surrender immediately. Do not try and send any wireless signals. Often they were out in the middle of the ocean where wireless signals couldn't reach land anyway. And most of these freighter captains really had no choice but to immediately surrender.
So what was her mission, Peter? What was the mission of the Wolf?
The mission was to go to the outlying regions, Australia and New Zealand. I think they knew from their intelligence network that we were pretty defenceless. We had a first-class navy, but at the outbreak of war, the deal was with the Australian government that our ships were sent under the control of the Royal Navy. So they were taken to the Mediterranean and Europe, where they didn't do much. We had the flagship, the Australia, which could have dropped anything it came, Germany could have sent. But it was out in the Atlantic, zigzagging around, doing nothing. I don't think it fired a shot. And New Zealand was even worse. They had nothing. One useless ship, the Philomel. And that was so leaky and hopeless, they just towed it to a dock and used it as an office.
That was the New Zealand Navy,
was
it?
New Zealand Navy. We had no minesweepers, no nothing. You know, just a few little motor torpedo boats.
So we were defenceless then?
We were defenceless from the water, yes.
And
we had no air force to speak of. And the secret to this success was sending the little Wolf ship up. It could spot, for hundreds of miles on a clear day, and it would just send flag messages back to the ship. But it would drop messages on the victim, it'd fly low over the deck, drop a bomb in the water, a message saying cease communication or we'll blow you out of the water.
So the mission was then to disrupt Allied shipping around Australia.
Yes.
So we were supplying a fair bit of foodstuff. Grain.
And South Africa. Grain. Look, he came around South Africa. Yeah. India. Ceylon, as it then was. Sri Lanka. Australia, New Zealand. New Guinea, went up to Singapore and turned around back again.
To stop grain supplies from Australia,
grain,
South Africa, and New Zealand.
And wool.
And everything
and
else.
And other essentials.
Which was going to Britain, clothe.
So it was only one ship, but if they'd sent a fleet of them, they would have been in desperate. They could have taken over Australia. Not much doubt about that.
And you write, Richard, that she had to the Wolf, once it was sent out, had to operate under strict secrecy. What did that mean for the way the Wolf had to operate once it was at sea?
The only way these raiders could survive was if no one could find them. They were a lone ship out in the middle of very few ships from the German Navy could get past the British blockade, which was in fact penning the German Navy in to the Baltic Sea. And so the raiders had this one chance of getting through the blockade and out into the ocean. Once they were out there, they were, of course, incredibly outnumbered. The French, Japanese and British and Australian navies were all hunting for them.
And they were slow too, weren't they?
And they were slow freighters. Yeah. So the only way to really survive was to maintain complete radio silence so that nobody could know where you were. And so the Wolf had very powerful transmitters and receivers, but the transmitters were never used. It picked up signals from the surrounding oceans, and the plane, the Wolfchen, would do a sort of 90-mile circulation around the ship to spot any dangers that were nearby. And
So it couldn't talk, but it could listen and it could look.
It could talk, but he gave directions not to.
Right.
Because that would give away. You see, a trained radio operator on a British or Australian ship could pick the spark of a Telefunken set because they're powerful and they have their own signature. So the moment he did that, they knew that, for one thing, there was a German around and where he was roughly. So Nerga cut off that supply. So it meant that the families of the German crew were as much victims as the Australians. They thought their loved ones had just disappeared.
Died.
Yeah, they had a funeral for them, in fact, towards the end.
Before they showed up again. We'll come to that too. Yeah, right. So they had to maintain radio silence, but they could hear. And they could send up their seaplane to look. So
that's right. And a lot of the messages, I have to say, there was a big cock-up in this regard, and we've mentioned this in the book. They didn't bother. They sent them en clair, which was French expression, in plain English.
The Australian Maritime Navy were sending out uncoded messages, which the Wolf was able to pick up, and that enabled it to know where to intercept
just
ships.
Sit in its path and wait for it.
Well,
and that's how my great-uncle's ship, the Matunga, a Burns Phillips ship, was captured. They just sent a message from Brisbane, arriving Rabaul such and such a time, with coal, et cetera, et cetera. There was a garrison, you see, in Rabaul, which
I don't want to jump too far ahead. I will come to that because that's. I want to begin with your personal connection to this story, Peter. You're the family historian.
Self-appointed. Self-appointed. Well, look, I did history at university with Manning Clark and at ANU, and that really fascinated me, and I. Well, collected Australiana, military history, and growing up in Canberra, I was surrounded by lots of military heroes of the Second War, and, you know, I just loved all that. And one day I thought I'll write all this up, and I'd toyed with the Wolf idea. I'd bought Alec Donaldson's book. He wrote that in the 20s. He was the captain of Matunga. And I had Roy Alexander's, who was a prisoner on Wolf, Australian. Wrote a very colourful book.
But they've all been out of print
for a long time. But my great uncle was chief engineer on the Matunga, but sadly he died about 10 years before I was born. And
so you
to
never
my
knew
knowledge,
him.
I never knew him, and he left nothing of his experiences except a couple of postcards from a POW camp.
Was there family folklore that you picked up?
Yes, there was. My grandmother used to mind us. She lived to her 90s and had all the marbles. She used to talk about it, but not in great detail, but how relieved they were. At the time the ship, her brother's ship, disappeared on the 6th of August, 17, just near Rabaul in New Britain, she was about 7 months pregnant with her last son. And they'd written him off. The newspaper reports were disappeared in an oceanic earthquake and the most unlikely stuff they peddled through the censorship system. And anyway, all the Matunga relatives written them off. So when her son was born in October 17, a couple of months later, she christened him Ross Ainsworth Honan, because she was an Ainsworth, she'd married a Honan. And so that uncle and I had a great relationship, and he died in 2003, and that's really when I started this story.
To get interest. Now, given that you are the self-appointed family historian, it took you a long while to get started, didn't it, Peter?
It did. I was in legal practice. I didn't have the time. And then, the bushfires went through Canberra, and the home I'd built 30 years previously was destroyed, and I'd just gone to the West, fortunately, and all the indications were, well, you know, don't go back. And I was a bit, put out by all that. I went into a downer for a while. The kids were all depressed. I was looking for a project, just something different from law for a while, and I drove up to Broome from Perth and stopped at Geraldton, and I saw the monument there to the sinking of the Sydney by the Cormoran in 1941. And it set me thinking, you know, we're slow learners, how did this Detmer's ship Cormoran get so close and trick, you know, Burnett, the captain of Sydney? Then I thought about, you know, what I'd read about the Wolf. Well, you know, he did it all the time. Lots of experienced sea captains were duped. And I was determined on the way back. I started thinking about it seriously. As soon as I got to Perth, I'd start looking at the records, what there was available on Wolf. And I looked at the official history. There's a volume in the 12-volume series by Bean, one written by Arthur Joes, who was Director of Naval Intelligence during the war, a former journalist. And that had a full chapter on raiders and minefields, and Wolf got quite a mention. And I bounced off some retired admirals I know and others that never heard of it and just, you know, dismissed me as being making it all up. And the more I delved, and the breakthrough was this lady friend in Perth. I could barely use a laptop. I'd had PAs all my life. And she just bought herself an Apple. And she said, "Oh, you discovered Google. Let's just Google in Wolf." And then up came this thing. Mike Fraser in New Zealand has translated Captain Nerga's book. So I rushed off an email, say, "Quick, send it to me," because my great-uncle was on the ship. And this guy, Mike Fraser, was responsible for my starting it, really, because as soon as I looked at Nerga's book and the colour in it, and then later, I had a story. If this is a human interest story in a war context, it's not just a dull old ship. It's 350 crew and 450 in round figures prisoners. Some of them died and went overboard and so on. But it was a tremendous achievement to have that many men, women and children on a ship and maintain discipline.
My guest this morning in conversation are co-authors of a book called The Wolf, the story of a German raider disguised itself as a freighter and held up an enormous amount of shipping around the Australian and New Zealand waters. My guests are Peter Honan and Richard Gilliatt, who are the authors of The Wolf. Can I bring you in now, Richard? How did you hear about this story?
Well, Peter had already done at least 2 or 3 years' research into the story when I first met him, and he had originally put together a proposal for a documentary film, a sort of synopsis, a 40-page treatment, and it found its way to a literary agent called Mary Kinane, who I knew, and she basically put us two together. She called me up and said, "Look, there's something here you really got to read," and sent it to me. As soon as I read what Peter had dug up, I just knew straight away what a great story it was. The thing that Peter had done, I guess from his training earlier in his life when he was studying history, was he'd gone right back to the government archives. He'd got the original cables that passed between Melbourne and London in 1917. He'd found, a journal written by the ship's engineer in the bowels of the ship as the Wolf was going around the world. He'd amassed this really fantastic archive of documents by basically hiring researchers around the world and PhD students and I don't know who else to track down descendants and sort of plough through the archives. And so at that point, Peter and I got together and I expressed my enthusiasm for the subject. Anytime as a writer that a project lands in your lap where someone else has already done 3 years of research, you're feeling pretty pleased about that.
And I've never left Australia to do any of this.
Done remotely.
I want to go and meet all these people that have been so wonderful. We've traced the surgeon on board, Herman Hausfeld, who did so much good work for the prisoners. His son's a retired medico in Germany. The Nerga family I'm familiar with, the grandsons and great-grandsons.
And Peter, were they all of the mind that why has no one told this story before?
Well, they knew it had been written by Roy Alexander, and it's been out of print probably 40 years. That was in the sort of father's library. They knew it had been written about some time ago. And yes, there was a lot of frustration that we feel this should be told properly. And we're really hoping that the German publishers will get the translation rights because it deserves to be told. I mean, he was a great fella and he had a sticky end, but it was an achievement unequalled. I challenge anyone to find something better, given the distance, the success in sinking ships with minimal loss of life, and bringing all those people safely home.
Let's talk about the captain. You mentioned him earlier, Peter. I'll just ask you, Richard, the captain, Carl Nerger. We'll talk about the voyage because I think we have to begin with the captain, don't we? Carl Nerger. Give me a bit of his background, please, Richard.
Well, he'd, as Peter said, grown up in Rostock, sort of middle-class family, career Navy man, but he was a bit of a black sheep in the Navy, German Navy, because he'd got his 16-year-old girlfriend pregnant early in his career, and that was a development that was really frowned on in the German Navy, particularly because she was the daughter of a sort of reasonably lowly sort of stevedore or wharfie in I think, Hamburg. And the German Navy at the time was incredibly elitist, and the division between the officers and the men was really strictly enforced. And
full of aristocratic twits by the
yes. sense. Yes. Yes. It was even stronger than that. You had to get the Kaiser's permission to marry, to make sure you weren't marrying beneath yourself, and he didn't get it. So he was living in sin.
So by the time the Wolf went to sea in late 1916, he had three illegitimate children with his wife. But he had a fantastic record as a captain. And in fact, what we found in the German archives was that one of the reasons they picked Nerger was because they thought he was lucky. He was actually a guy who had survived two battles before the war and during the war, which he should have been killed in. And the raider ships had a pretty dire history. Most of them never came back. You know, they were known as suicide ships in the German Navy, and so they figured they needed a captain who was lucky.
Who was lucky and fearless, it would seem, as well. Like he could stand on the deck while half his ship was going under him and not bat an eyelid.
That's the description.
And a very careful planner.
And a careful planner, meticulous, a gentleman. Humane in his treatment. He's really quite an outstanding figure, this captain, isn't he? He comes across very well in your book, this German naval captain. So they take the Wolf out on its maiden voyage, out of the Baltic Sea, which is where the Germans had their port of Kiel there, and they had to get out of the Baltic Sea into the Atlantic. Now, to do that, they have to either go through the English Channel, which was impossible, or through the around the back of Ireland. Mm. How did they escape, Richard? How did they get past that blockade?
The British had a whole flotilla of ships which were cutting off trade in that northern part between Scotland and Norway. And, I mean, Nerger was actually lucky. You know, he came out of the Baltic Sea into the North Sea when there was an incredible fog just enshrouding everything. And by the time he got north of Scotland, this howling gale came in, which reduced visibility to zero. And so he had to go up really near the Arctic Sea and then come down between Iceland and Greenland. And he basically managed to do it just by sheer luck of doing it while the weather conditions permitted him to sneak through without being observed.
So lucky again.
Well, there were accounts, though, that ships did pass him and didn't challenge him.
Yes. Because he looked like a freighter?
Well, he looked like a harmless old tramp steamer. And the other thing that we haven't mentioned, he could change his appearance, but they also painted the ship different colours. You see, they had this fantastic workforce.
So it was painted black, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was black and white when it left, and then later they changed it to an entirely black ship. So all of these things enabled them to alter the ship's appearance. And he had 350 men, of course, so it was a phenomenal workforce available to him.
So he escapes and he goes in between Iceland and Greenland, where it's a bit chilly, to say the least.
Past icebergs.
Past icebergs, and he ends up... he heads towards... Cape Town.
That's right.
In South Africa.
That's where he lays his first mine.
Yes. Now, Peter, take me through that process, the dangerous process of what you had to do in order to...
They had to lay mines. Short distance. It was all in fairly shallow water. And he got in close to Cape Town. This is very well described by his gunnery officer. And he remarked how slack the crew were. The searchlights just sort of wandered around. They're all...
They were not looking.
Ship had been down there before, so they're dropping all their mines around Cape Town.
These gigantic metal, highly explosive eggs, aren't
and
they?
And they're down where Great Uncle and his mates were down in the hole alongside, so they knew anything hit them, they're all, destined for higher places.
So what, did they have to winch them out or something and drop them in the...
They went up on a lift.
Right.
And then down a trolley system and then just dropped off the back.
weren't they noticed doing what they were doing?
They're bobbing around? No, yes. Apparently not. Well, look, this whole story is a sorry tale of slackness on the part of the Allies. Complacency. You see, as far as Australia was concerned, we'd knocked off the Emden very early in the war, but the Sydney had knocked it off in the Cocos Islands. That's in 14. And then by 17, we were complacent. There was no sign of any German threats, although the Australian Navy did have apprehension as soon as the word got out that there was a raider in the Indian Ocean. They said, what if it comes over our way? We got nothing.
But nothing was done.
South Africa had no navy either, and then they went up to India, which was defenceless, and dropped them around Bombay. And the mother of a former law partner of mine, her ship got dropped with a loss of life.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio and the World Wide Web.
Today you're hearing one of the great untold stories of the First World War, the story of the Wolf. The Wolf was a clever raider ship devised by the Germans to look like a freighter. It showed up in Australian waters, managed to capture the contents of some of those freighter ships and take its crew and people on board as prisoners. It's one of the most remarkable stories of the war indeed. And the authors of this book are Richard Gilliatt and Peter Honan. They're both with me at the moment. Richard's a journalist with The Australian, and Peter is a lawyer with a family connection to one of the prisoners of war that were held on board the Wolf way back in the First World War. Before the headlines there, we were talking about them laying mines quite successfully at Cape Town, then around Bombay, Peter, as you say. And that's when they're coming around towards Aden in the Middle East, and they captured a ship there called the Turritella. Richard, tell me about that process, how they captured this ship.
After they'd laid a couple of hundred mines, Nerga decided to start doing raiding, which involves capturing freighters and sinking them. And the first one they encountered was, as you say, the Turritella, which was actually originally a German ship, which the British had captured, and now Nerga was recapturing it.
They pulled up and they went, this looks a bit familiar, this ship, doesn't it? It was almost exactly like their own, wasn't it?
Turned out it had come off the same production line as as the Wolf.
But it was a genuine freighter.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. So there was a very elaborate ritual that raiders had to enact because they weren't allowed to kill any. The crew and passengers on freighters were, of course, civilians. And so under the rules of warfare, the raiders were not allowed to kill any of those people. And so there was this elaborate ritual whereby they would approach the ship, raise the German flag, fire a warning shot, and basically tell the ship to sort of pull over, we're coming on board. And then they were obligated to take the crew and prisoners, prisoner on their ship before they sank the freighter. And that's in fact exactly what happened in all of these situations.
But they didn't sink the Turritella.
Indeed, you're right.
They didn't sink this, and they had come to regret it. You write in the book that they actually made it into the SMS Iltis, I think.
That's right.
Yes, and sent it off on a mine-laying mission in the Gulf of Aden where they were captured. But the crew on board, as you write, were mainly Chinese sailors on this British ship who were quite happy to work for the Germans because they had no nationality in common. And that's when they were captured by the British, they told of the Wolf. And so this is when the British first get an inkling.
And they got a very good sketch of it, which was circulated.
So then the warning goes to the Admiralty
in
London.
This is March 17. Yep.
But there is a commerce raider out there disguised as a freighter. What response then does the Admiralty have, Peter, once it knows that there is a raider operating in almost defenceless waters?
Not very much. The Naval Board in Australia were pretty well beholden to the Royal Navy, of course, because they were in supreme command. And
Weren't they alarmed? I mean, given that this was a threat to their
food
supplies.
Oh, I don't think so. Not because that didn't matter to them very much. Their immediate crisis was the Atlantic and the waters around England. This was one ship. I suppose they thought, what can one ship do?
So, Richard, does Australia then become aware that there's a commerce raider operating from this at this moment?
The Australian government, in fact, announced that there was a raider. In fact, Billy Hughes, the Prime Minister at the time, who was about to go to an election, announced that it was 100 miles off the West Australian coast, which was about 2,500 miles wrong. But certainly they announced the details of the ship and that it was heading towards Australia. And so the Australian Navy was certainly alarmed by this because they had been begging the British for at least some warships to help protect Australia and had warned the British on a number of occasions that Australia was and New Zealand were essentially defenceless.
So we had no help coming from the Royal Navy, of course, because they had their own battle to fight in the in the Atlantic. So that's when the Australian government called on the Japanese Navy to come to their help.
Well, actually, that was stitched up with the British. The Australians weren't terribly happy about it, and there's some acrimonious correspondence we've uncovered between Admiral Yamaji, wasn't it, Richard?
Yes.
And our Admiral Creswell, when we asked for help from Shikuma and Harado, I think were the two Japanese light cruisers in our waters, saying, look, there's a raider most likely in New Guinea waters, Matanga's disappeared, and then we've got the correspondence from the Japanese Admiral saying, oh, the evidence isn't very convincing, it's probably hit a reef or something of the sort, you know, we wouldn't know where to start. And they didn't do much. They didn't respond. It was very half-hearted. But it was the English-Japanese alliance that foisted on us, the Japanese. I mean, we didn't choose that way.
So more ships start to disappear.
Around New Zealand.
Around New Zealand. How did the Australian government then explain away these mysteriously disappearing ships, Richard?
Well, the English, the British government, from the moment they learned about the Wolf from the Chinese crew that had been captured from the Turritella, completely suppressed any public information about the Wolf. The name of the ship was never released. And in fact, the Australian government's announcement was the only, that there was this raider armed with a seaplane, was the only public acknowledgement we ever found about the raiders, about the Wolf's mission. So by the time the Wolf did get to the waters off Australia in about May 1917, there'd been a complete clampdown on any public acknowledgement of what the ship was and where it was.
Why?
Well, because the British knew that Australia was defenceless, and so they would have been embarrassed to admit that. And secondly, they didn't. Their main game, as Peter says, was to defend England, the North Sea and the Atlantic from U-boats, and they didn't want any news that would put pressure on them to divert warships down to the outer reaches of the empire. And so it was in their interest to make sure that nobody publicly knew that the Wolf was out there.
Because that would mean
the
to acknowledge we were defenceless.
The so they would have panicked. Panic and force the politicians to do something.
So how did Billy Hughes explain away the disappearing ships then, Peter?
German saboteurs.
German saboteurs.
You see, we became a very anti-Hun society, and as you probably know, in Queensland, the Darling Downs particularly, Bundaberg, Barossa in South Australia, the pockets of very strong German
settlements,
migration from the 19th century.
So and they were blamed?
Second and third German Australians who are very industrious and so on, and some of them were in uniform, and there's a separate story about how they were picked on. German place names were changed. There was this anti-German hysteria. And so Hughes saw his opportunity to ramp up his conscription campaign. Let's turn everyone against the Germans in Australia, you know, the big victimisation thing. And they changed the regulations under the War Precautions Act towards the end so that if anyone had even a grandparent born in Germany, they were deemed to be an enemy alien, and they could just be arrested summarily on
and
any
interned.
Suspicion and interned. No legal process, no nothing, and it happened to Newman.
So politics is all about the art of the possible, isn't it? And Billy Hughes sees this threat to our waters as being an opportunity,
I suppose. And they said that either Irish rebels, because the Catholics were dead against conscription and the Irish question, he divided Australian society and probably destroyed a German society that formed. And the Premier of Queensland, I have to say, I'll put in a plug for Queensland, Ryan, opposed Hughes vigorously. They came to blows at some function in Brisbane.
Physical blows?
Yeah, well, threw a cup of tea over him at a function, and Ryan was dead against all this, and he had a large German electorate, and they were saying that either Irish saboteurs were acting in conjunction with Germans, that were German nationals planting bombs on ships in the wharf.
So this then, Richard, is Billy Hughes, isn't it? He rather than admit that Australian waters were defenceless, he couldn't, in fact, admit that.
He internalised it.
He internalised it, found a subgroup in Australian society and arrested them.
That's right. By about August 1917, a number of ships had either disappeared, that is, they'd been captured by the Wolf off Australia, or they'd sunk due to explosions. And what they'd done is hit the minefields that the Wolf had laid off the southeast Victorian coastline and off New Zealand. And it was a pretty tricky thing trying to explain these explosions because, you know, clearly an explosion that can sink a 7,000 or 8,000-tonne freighter is substantial. But the rationale that was come up with was that it was these, you know, these fiendish German or Irish saboteurs or possibly perhaps a German fisherman towing a mine out off Gabo Island.
Towing a mine.
Well, that's what Charles Newman was accused of doing, and he had 2 years in the jug even when they knew the Wolf had done it.
This is a German Australian, otherwise known as Carl Newman, who copped the blame for
He was a fisherman who lived.
That's a story in its own right.
Yes, a very sad story indeed. So this is the ramifications of the Wolf's unimpeded operations in the Australian waters and around the area.
And he was laughing in his book, Carl. I should send it to you, Carl Nurger's book. Just laughing in the newspaper reports they got from the captured ships about all these
German saboteurs,
and
it was actually him all
South
along.
South Africa was the same, and they wanted to export everyone, kick them back to Germany, even if they'd been born there.
I want to bring in now the Cameron family because their story is just remarkable. Mm. Richard, the Cameron family. Tell me who they were and how they got picked up by the Wolf.
Mary Cameron was a young Australian, very adventurous young Australian woman in 1907 when she was 17 years old. She was living in Newcastle with her family on the docks, and she fell for an American sailor who'd sailed into town and within 2 weeks had married him and basically gone off to sea with him. They went back to San Francisco where Stan Cameron lived, and they had a couple of kids. And by 1917, she was desperate to come back to Australia and see her mother, who was not very well. And so they decided to undertake this journey across the Pacific in the middle of World War I to go to from San Francisco to Newcastle with their six-year-old daughter, Juanita.
Leaving the four-year-old behind.
Leaving their four-year-old daughter back in San Francisco, as you do.
As you do. Right. But we'll be back in a couple of months, or we'll be well. So they were on the ship that he was captaining called the Beluga.
Which was a sailing ship.
A whaler.
A whaler.
Yeah.
And where did they get picked up by the Wolf?
They got to within 1,000 miles of Sydney. They were just below New Caledonia. They'd been at sea for a couple of months and increasingly excited about getting to Australia when this black ship suddenly appeared, this freighter.
And then when that was revealed as a raider, a German raider, what fears did the Cameron family have for their well-being?
Well, there was immediate panic. Stan was, imagine how you'd feel.
The Hun.
Wife and child,
yes.
Here were the nasty Huns, and Mary pulls a revolver from under the pillow and says, Stan, don't let them take us alive. But as soon as the boarding party came on board, Lieutenant Zelasco, from memory, he had perfect English with an American accent. He served in the American
Merchant Navy,
and they'd worked out they'd been on the same ship. So they relaxed, and the Germans were as courteous as possible. They let Mary take her sewing machine on board and asked touches like that. And as soon as they came aboard Wolf, the second in command said, you have nothing to fear. We are not the Huns you think we are.
He says that. We are not the Huns you think we are.
Because the propaganda in the papers was terrible. They were seen as drooling guerrillas, raping and murdering babies and so on. That was all through the Australian Bulletin. Norman Lindsay was the most prominent one. But it was in the American press too. And so
they had this, their daughter, they brought the little girl on board, and how old was she?
Six.
Juanita?
Juanita was six, but she became the mascot. She had no fear.
Tell me what happened when she was brought on board the Wolf.
She was on board, and they cooked a special pudding for her and made a big fuss. So she was a hit with all the lonely sailors missing their kids, and made a huge fuss of her. The captain made a fuss of her. She dined with them specially. Made friends with Darling Paul, as she called him, Fay Beck, the pilot of Wolfshan.
The seaplane, yes.
And
fell in love with him, didn't she?
Yes.
Isn't that sweet?
Yeah. Well, there's a photo in the back of the book of them holding hands.
It's really...
So, look, it's a wonderful story of their humanity, and, you know, you can imagine in a different context, a different war, people like that being treated in a very savage fashion. And yet... he was a bit of lightheartedness, and she just had the run of the ship. She used to go into Nerga's cabin and play with his papers and so on, till he, you know, she went a bit too far.
So they're amongst some of the most interesting passengers or prisoners on board the Wolf. But there was another one, Guy Haxton. Who was Guy Haxton?
Gerald Haxton, actually.
Gerald, I beg your pardon.
Yeah.
Richard discovered him.
After the Wolf left the Australia-New Zealand area, it ended up in September 17, south of India, and it picked up a Japanese liner called the Hitachi Maru, which had about 60 passengers, and many of those were English colonialists, and among them was Gerald Haxton. We were mystified as to who this guy was. He was mentioned in the book in passing in certain records we'd seen as an American who was on board the ship. I finally managed to track down his name in a news report of a prisoner in one of the German internment camps in 1918, where he'd ended up. And it turned out he gave his next of kin as W.S. Maugham of the Bath Club, London.
Somerset Maugham.
That's right. And so I quickly consulted a couple of Somerset Maugham biographies and discovered that
he picked up on that.
Gerald Haxton was, in fact, Somerset Maugham's quote-unquote secretary, which in 1917 was a code word for lover, because Maugham, of course, was secretly a homosexual. And Gerald Haxton was probably one of the most notorious gay men of his era. He'd been deported from Britain some years earlier.
He
was put on trial for licentious behaviour, and he was a notorious drunk, and he and Maugham had recently, in fact, cut a swathe through the South Pacific together.
So there's the gay lover of Somerset Maugham aboard the Wolf, and he's just taken prisoner on board. It's just a remarkable thing to uncover there. Were there escape attempts? Did anyone try and get out into a lifeboat?
When they're in the Kermadecs, an uninhabited group of islands north of New Zealand, Cleland and Steers, weren't they, Richard?
That's right.
Two guys from Tarratella did a runner, and it remains a mystery. I've gone through all the records in England and New Zealand, and, look, there were rumours that a Japanese warship picked them up, but the reality is the sharks got them, or they died of exposure on those islands. No food, very little water. They were never discovered, and we found letters from the relatives writing to various authorities saying what's happened to them. They did. The New Zealand authorities did send a search party to look for them after the war. There was no sign of them.
My guests this morning are two men who have uncovered the story of the Wolf, a German raider ship that terrorised the southern seas during the First World War, and their book is indeed called The Wolf. Richard Gilliatt and Peter Honan are here this morning. Tell me about the return voyage, Richard, because the voyage was to go through the North Sea, up round Greenland, down to Cape Town, through the Indian Ocean, into the Pacific, around Australia and New Guinea, and up through the Indian Ocean and back to Germany. Why was the return voyage so horrible for the Wolf?
After the Wolf had been at sea for about a year, it ended up back really off the coast of South Africa, having done this extraordinary loop around Australia and past Singapore and back through the Indian Ocean. Nerga at this point had the incredible good fortune to capture a collier, and so had finally got a Spanish collier, and had finally got enough coal to get him back to Germany. The problem was that...
So he was just waiting to get enough coal, in other words, was he?
Right. They were so low on coal on a number of occasions that the mission looked like it was going to end in disaster. Food and coal were always running out.
And space, he had 900 on board.
900 people on board the ship, how many was it fit to hold?
350.
Yeah. So there they were off the coast. He eventually had decided to keep the Spanish collier, which was called the Igotsmendi, and put sort of maybe 30 or 40 of his older or the women, children, those sort of prisoners, onto the other ship, onto the Spanish ship, just to give himself a bit of space. And so the two ships would then had to go up through the Atlantic in the middle of winter in a savage sort of storm, one of the worst on record during that period. If they survived that, they then had to go through those waters that they'd come out through
heavily patrolled British ships. Yes.
Through what they thought was going to be the British blockade again, except in the interim, while they'd been away, the Germans had announced unrestricted submarine warfare. Their submarines were sinking any ship they encountered in the North Sea. So they just looked like any other freighter. And so they faced just as much danger from a German U-boat as they did from the British Navy. Mm. And so that's what they did. They set off on this 3,000 or 4,000 mile perilous voyage back to Germany.
And what did the living conditions get like in the quarters, Peter, for the prisoners?
Pretty grim. They were doubled up, and rations were very short by this stage.
Scurvy broke out too, didn't it?
Scurvy broke out, and we could never determine the death rate. The wolf. We have the official diary from Germany, and that didn't record all that, but quite a few were lost.
So they're seasick
and hungry. No women, only the men. The ones down in the hold, where my great-uncle was, didn't fare as well, obviously. The married ones tend to be treated better. So there were quite a few deaths, but not, you know, an outstanding number, because they managed to get, you know, they were crabs, I think, the crab meat, tin crab meat from Igotsmendi, which everyone was hardly sick of, and rice. But they were pretty fair in divvying up the rations. I don't think the prisoners had much less than the working men, the sailors.
So what happened when, as they were approaching, coming back to Kiel again, to the German port in the Baltic Sea, what happened when the German Admiralty, the Admiralstab, found out about their existence?
Didn't believe them?
Well, the of course, Nerga couldn't transmit a signal still, to, you know, right to the very end. And so the German Navy didn't know he was on his way back. He had to maintain radio silence throughout the voyage.
So they'd be given up for dead?
Yes.
The death notices had actually gone out in the weeks that the Wolf was approaching Germany. In fact, the last of them were by sheer coincidence sent out in the very day that the Wolf finally came through, because having run this gauntlet of British warships and submarines, the Wolf miraculously made it back to Germany in about February 1918. The Igotsmendi, the Spanish ship, which had the Cameron family aboard it and a number of others, commanded by a German officer called Karl Rose, had lost the Wolf during this voyage and was trailing about 3 or 4 days behind it.
And when it arrived back in Kiel, what kind of reception did it get, Peter?
Well, wonderful. We've got many shots of that. Heroes, of course, because Germany was not doing well and they desperately need a success story. And here was this ship that had gone around the world and brought back all sorts of treasures that Germany needed in the hold from the Japanese ships and silk and things of that sort that they're in short supply.
And the Cameron family and their daughter, they were on the other ship.
They were on the other ship, but they were released in Denmark.
They were released in Denmark, but they weren't in good shape, were they?
They weren't too bad. Look, they needed a good feed. One of the most cheerful ones was a fellow called Courtney Dickens, a bit of a hero. He was a lawyer from Singapore, Englishman, who'd taken up with a widow who was a pistol-packing gin swiller, and they provided some great characters on board. I'd have to say, if I wanted to be on a ship, I'd be on Igotsmendi with Karl Rose. He's a man after my own heart. He had champagne parties every night, bridge parties for his favourites. He pursued the wife, Rose Flood, of the Australian doctor. With some success, I believe.
Charming rogue like yourself then, Peter. Is that a fair way to describe it?
And he distributed the grog around, his favourites, and they had a ball, and he took his eye off the main task and ran aground. So there's a moral to all this, I suppose. He missed out on his Iron Cross and ends up in the jug in Denmark, very pissed off.
So the war ends that year. It comes to an end.
Yeah.
And one thing I have to say about your book, it's changed my whole thinking about the First World War, because so much of the histories that are written about it focus on what happened in France, and quite rightly so, perhaps, at some level.
Yeah.
But really, it becomes clear reading your book that once those two gigantic armies or coalitions came to a stalemate in France and Belgium, then it was actually a war of starvation between Britain and Germany. Who could starve the other power into submission? And in the end, Britain and its allies won because the German population was starving because of this warfare at sea.
And Plivia, we mentioned this in the book, the Plivia, the fellow on the lower deck who later became a communist sympathiser and defected to Russia, he wrote about the appalling circumstances he found his parents in when he returned and the starvation. And
in the streets of Germany, yes.
Yes.
His father had in fact died only a month or so before the wolf got back.
No, dying of malnutrition, and there's some very sad. His book's a good one.
And your great uncle Peter, what? How did he make his way?
I've got a photograph of him. He met up with one of his other brothers who'd served in the artillery, and there's a photo in London. He doesn't look too bad. And when the ships return to Australia, there's a shot of Donaldson, the captain, and Norman
Pine,
and they look pretty robust. They were a pretty tough lot. Look, I think you've been at sea from 14 or so.
And they'd all grown up on bread and dripping anyway.
Yeah,
so they
hadn't had much.
Hadn't had much anyway.
And they had time in Denmark for a good feed. I mean, Courtney Dickinson, the Singapore lawyer, was a bon vivant, and he and the pistol packer, fiancé, they went up to the best hotel and dined out. I've got his letters, you see, from the Admiralty.
Well, look, it's a fantastic tale. I just have to very briefly ask you, who's making the movie of this?
It is
one of those great tales.
I hope Steven Spielberg will
Spielberg,
take it.
Is it? Is that it?
Well,
our people are talking to their people.
It'd have to be American. It's a big budget job, but I'd love to see it made with an Australian actress. I can see Cate Blanchett as Mary Cameron.
I
just hope she reads it.
I could see you as Carl Nerger, quite frankly, Peter,
but
just putting on the accent. It's been great to meet you both, and thank you so much for coming to tell this great unknown story of the First World War. Richard Gilliatt and Peter Honan, thank you so much for being here
today. Thanks for your enthusiasm, Richard.
Thank you, Richard.
On ABC Local Radio, Conversations with Richard Feidler.